Cider. Oh, I guess we're doing this. We're just recording now. Oh, stressful day, but I'm going to be a lot less stressed now because not only am I talking about something I like a lot, I'm talking with someone I like a lot. So it's kind of a good, it's a twofer for me, which is awesome. Back by popular demand, Silas Rossi. Actually, how nobody. I'm good. Actually, nobody's has been like, hey, can you get Silas back on? But I'm like, we need to get Silas back on.
Well, it's only been 12 hours since the last one went to air. So
that's correct. Your episode launched today.
We got to give people a minute.
Yeah. So, this is a topic I really, really like. And I was kind of inspired from my guiding yesterday. Had a client that Silas and I both know very well and have worked with quite a bit. And we were out ice climbing and in this beautiful spot in Western Maine. And long story short, it kind of follows this stream bed. So there's a couple pitches of ice climbing, technical ice climbing. And then there's like about 150 yards, maybe 200 yards of short roping, like little legitimate short roping and short pitching up this stream bed, up the steppy ice and snow features to another area where there's some more, a couple more pitches of technical climbing. And we went up there with my client, and did all that stuff and then came back down. So you have to do the short roping, short pitching on the way down to some technical descents to get back down to the bottom. And the thing that really got me fired up was the actual process of the short roping and short pitching, but more specifically about kind of managing the rope. And that's a type of thing I really enjoy. So being in third and fourth class terrain, wherever that is, on snow or rock, and being able to move efficiently through that terrain, utilizing the rope, a shortened rope. So really the kind of the basis of this is shortening the rope. When we choose to shorten the rope, what are our goals? How do we do it? And maybe some concepts and theories kind of behind that. And as I was thinking about this topic, I got really excited and it's kind of expansive. There's a lot of nuance to it and a lot of details and a lot of things that go into that when you're in that terrain, besides just like, I'm going to shorten the rope. There's a lot more to that. And I was getting so excited about it. And I was like, I really want to get into the weeds with this one. And I felt like, surprisingly, for the first time, maybe not the first time, but on this podcast, I felt like I need some backup on this. I need someone who A, knows this really well, and B, also has thought a lot about it in the terms, in the context of teaching it to both recreational users of the mountains, but also guides. And I think that's a really big distinction with Silas, is that because of his years on the IT, the AMGA, he's had a lot of opportunity to present this in both rock terrain, but also alpine terrain. And where I tend to present it here or there with guide training, just with our staff, but not really as extensively, but I certainly think about it a lot. So very excited, Silas, to have you here. But let's get into it. So shortening rope is an interesting thing. It's kind of like this really interesting combination of tradition, technique, and technology. Like, I think all of these things kind of come together, and we'll talk maybe a little bit more about that later. But I oftentimes think when we're shortening the rope, more often than not, it's a technique of transition. It's not like we tend to just shorten the rope and leave it like that. I think the exception or the caveat would be walking on glaciated terrain. We're like, all right, we're going to rope up for glacier travel. We're shortening the rope. And it's kind of like the mode that we travel in potentially the whole day back to when we get off the glacier. Not that you couldn't lengthen or shorten the rope depending on the terrain there, but oftentimes you're just walking on glacial terrain, you're going to set it and forget it for the day. I'm thinking more like when we're in that third and fourth class and low fifth class terrain, or full fifth class terrain, why we might choose to shorten the rope, and what benefits it gains us and how we can manage it. So, Silas.
What's happening?
My question is your initial thoughts? Your initial thoughts on that whole piece.
I think it's great. I think you're right. It's a huge topic. We chatted this morning for a few minutes and it kind of got my gears turning a little bit throughout the day. And I had some drive time, so I was kind of mulling it over a little bit. Not a ton, but kind of like just kept coming back to it. And for me, it's so cool because short roping, like as a broad topic, and you mentioned shortening the rope, which I think is a good point. It's short pitching, short roping, moving together with less than the full length of rope. It is like the essence of alpinism. Like you picture alpinism and you see two people on some mountain connected by a rope. That's the iconic image. And it's not like, you know, how they're like clipped into the mountain with carabiners and anchors and pitons. And like, you just see two people in a rope and they're not usually like 200 feet apart. Right. So there's a whole bunch I want to get into so much with this, but the reason we call it shortened rope or short roping is that now our ropes are so darn long. Like you think about 100 years ago, we didn't have 200 or 250 foot long ropes. We had maybe 100 feet, maybe 80 feet. So people would actually be traveling around in what we would consider now a shortened rope setting, but that was the full length of rope. So there's a couple of concepts that I was thinking about a lot today. And I always try to think like big picture first, like terrain, and then kind of techniques and then tools, right? Like kind of like working from like big picture to small picture details. And I think it's neat because the essence of moving with a shortened rope is not immediate security, but ultimate security, right? Like our movement is our primary security. And maybe if we don't have a rope on at all, we're just moving along and trucking along on moderate terrain. Then you get on a terrain that's a little bit harder or a little bit more exposed. And all of a sudden you have this rope on. And just by virtue of it being shortened, now you can utilize a counterbalance around terrain or across terrain. So if you think about like this fin of snow, steep fin of snow, a rut, and two people were walking on it, unroped, and one person falls off, one person dies. But if one person falls off one side and the other person jumps off the opposite side, now they're counterbalanced. Or your example of glacier travel, right? Walking across a flat glacier, person punches in the crack, they're going to either get stopped by people, hopefully self-arresting, or worst case, like counterbalancing another crack, right? So yeah, I think it's so cool. And the idea is like with a shortened enough piece of rope, you now can counterbalance safely and not fall too far, right? You counterbalance with a 200 foot rope, you might as well not have rope on at all. But you counterbalance with 30 feet of rope or 50 feet of rope, depending on the terrain, and you might just have a short little fall. A caveat being the rope has to be somewhat snug between you, right? So yeah, there's so much to dig in here to. And I always think about the big picture first. Like, what are you trying to do? You're trying to prevent like ultimate failure of falling off the mountain, right? So you're introducing oftentimes some kind of counterbalance, either over terrain, around terrain, like a horn or something. Or maybe you're placing gear and kind of simulclimbing, and you're just counterbalanced ultimately if someone were to fall in some piece of gear. You know, in New England, we have trees, right? A lot of times you can walk across a ledge system with trees. And if you walk across a ledge system above a cliff with no trees and no rope, you fall to your death. You walk above a cliff system that has trees, but you have a rope on, and now you have some kind of counterbalance feature that you can protect the team from falling off the mountain. So that's where my brain goes first with all this short roping stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I was thinking. I actually thought a similar thought was like, it's like almost pure climbing team movement in the mountains, right? It's like, yeah, it is like the iconic, like we're moving through the mountains and we have a rope on for that ultimate security. And you know, a lot of it is that, like you said, like the foundation is oftentimes reading the terrain and understanding that terrain, not only about when to apply that technique, but also length is a big piece. Like the terrain tells us the length. But I want to get back to this really quickly, is it's about ultimate security, right? And I think a lot of people and this has been pushed for a long time in mountaineering, is like, oh, it's dangerous, it's exposed, I'll add a rope, that makes me safe. Remember, adding a rope in the mountains does not make you safe. Only using a rope properly in the mountains will increase your safety. So if you're climbing together, even on a shortened rope, in an exposed area, and you have no capacity for counterbalance, you're just going to both fall off the mountain. You know, one person is going to fall and the other person, and it's going to rip the other person off. So there needs to be
the classic, like, volcano glacier travel to the steep snow slope, but no protection, right?
So, like, the concept of the running belay on snow would, like, you're just roped up and climbing and there's no intermediary protection between you is really a fallacy. And especially, and still, if you add another layer to that, like, oh, well, we have snow pickets. Forget that. If you're in a couloir and you get good rock gear or ice gear, different story. But just a bunch of snow pick. Hey, first of all, how many snow pickers are you carrying? Second of all, like, good luck, right? So that whole thing's a fallacy. Like, oh, we'll just add snow pickets as we're doing this running belay. And there have been some major accidents that have caused fatalities, both within a group, but also a group doing that and pulling and coming down, essentially clotheslining other groups, and having injuries and accidents. So it's a real fallacy. But let's talk about when we're actually utilizing the rope, a shortened rope, and in that kind of, we're actually either using terrain features or actually placing gear, or we're talking about short roping or short pitching. And just let's do this really quickly. Short roping and short pitching is not the same thing. They oftentimes are considered the same thing or thought the same thing. They are very similar in some ways, and we oftentimes flow in and out of them, like, all the time. But I really think of short roping as the art of two people moving together, where the person in front who's providing the short rope, is their stance is providing the security for the second person or persons on the team. And you're really trying to prevent a little slip in terrain that is exposed from turning into a major fall and then therefore pulling off the other team. But the team is moving together, right, with a shortened rope. Where short pitching is like, we need to add more security to this system, which means the person in front, if you're going up, or the person in the back, if you're coming down, is stopping and providing a more secure belay, which could be literally as simple as stopping with a good stance and just providing a hand belay. Or it could even be putting a piece of gear in, using a rock feature, some sort of body belay, but we're actually making these little short pitches to actually move down the mountain. So it's a little bit more like a caterpillar versus everybody's fluidly moving up or fluidly moving down. And it's a big difference for sure. And I just want to make sure people get that, because I don't always think people do.
Yeah, I would add one thing to that. And I think your example was a really good and spot on in a guiding context, right? And I think that a lot of times recreational parties actually could benefit a lot from using a shortened rope, but their tendency typically is just to go unroped. So, you know, basically for me, if there's a fall hazard that exists where the results are bad enough, I'm gonna have a rope on. So, and it's kind of like, if it's above like fourth class, like whether it's 5.1 or 5.2 or hard fourth class, like I'm probably gonna have a rope on if I can fall off the mountain and die, whether I'm guiding or if I'm climbing personally. I mean, sure, like, have I ever been in terrain like that without a rope on? Of course. But I think as a habit for most recreational parties, I don't think it's really that smart just to lose the rope and then get into terrain, especially if you don't know it well, or there's variable conditions. So I think that a lot of recreational parties actually could benefit a lot from having a shortened rope. And, you know, the benefit of the shortened rope is not only the counterbalance benefit, but also just less to manage, right? Like, it's kind of like, if I don't have a double rack on my harness and a 70 meter rope out that I'm trying to manage through a lot of moderate kind of steppy, rocky, loose terrain, but I have like maybe four or five cams out and four or five knots out and 50 feet of rope, it just gets way easier to manage that rope. And in that kind of terrain, a lot of times it's the risk of rock fall is pretty prevalent. So all those dangers go way down too. So I think, again, my major point, like, recreational parties could actually benefit a lot from short roping and short pitching, kind of out of that guiding context, just by using the rope around horns of rock features, or placing some quick gear, or using terrain features like horns or rocks or ridges or trees, that sort of stuff, quite a bit. The other thing I'll say is that we, like in this short pitch conversation, outside of a guiding context, to your point earlier, we're not talking about steep snow. So in my mind, steep snow is different. And as guides, we oftentimes will short up on steep snow to safeguard a less experienced or skilled person from having the likelihood of them falling being quite high, reduced quite a bit by them being attached to us, right? So because we're so solid in that terrain where we would just solo on our own recreationally, we might offer a short rope for a client because they're less experienced and less reliable in that terrain to not slip, where a slip could become a fall and be a big issue, right? So on snow, outside of a guiding context, and even in a guiding context, sometimes if it's steep enough, you couldn't hold a fall, we go into more pitched climbing. And so on a steep homogeneous snow slope, anchors are harder and more timely to get, right? There's not a lot available. So like pounding a picket or a dead man or ice anchors, like those things take time. So typically because the ratio of time spent on the anchor building is longer than actually doing the climbing on the pitch, we'll lengthen the rope out to the full rope length and just do an actual pitch. So steep snow slope, I walk up where I start feeling like I could fall off here, put an actual anchor in, pickets, ice axe, ice screws, whatever, do a pitch, full rope length, put another anchor in because we don't have a lot of pickets to your point, and then continue that process, right? That's kind of like steep snow, whether you're guiding or recreational climbing. But in ridgy, rocky, steppy terrain, we're using the steppiness of the terrain to isolate certain sections of hard climbing between rests, right? Like classic rock ridge sort of setting. And in that situation, you can like use horns and flip things. So short pitching becomes more advantageous. And because the time to sit down behind our stance or to wrap a horn is very small, right? Versus the time it takes people to climb in that terrain, especially given kind of like complicated route finding, is pretty lengthy. So we're flipping the time, our time, where we're using our time mostly. Snow slopes, easy and fast to climb, but hard to anchor. Steppy, rocky terrain is easy to anchor, but hard to route find the easiest way all the time, or the safest way from a rockfall perspective. So short pitching happens on rock more, but long pitching happens on snow, and short roping only happens on snow in a guiding context versus in a recreational context, could be in a rock ridge or scrambling sort of setting quite often.
Nice. Yeah, I think some of the key points there is, like, once again, it ties back to terrain, right? So reading the terrain and understanding, like, okay, I think it's time to shorten the rope and then move through this in this way, allows us to be more efficient. Even though you might be moving slower in terms of your pace, it's constant or more constant versus pitching, where you're pitching something out, you might climb a little faster maybe, but you're stopping to build anchors, which is time. Like you said, you're flipping time, you know, and as we get to that kind of in-between terrain where it's like, it's technical enough where you might want some protection if you fall because it would be consequential. Now it's time to think about that rope. And I think where I want to go in this conversation is talk a little bit about some of the technique, because the ability to read the terrain, adjust the rope length to the appropriate length, but also be able to manipulate that rope length as needed back and forth is pretty key. Like you should be pretty fluid and be able to either make the rope a little longer or make the rope a little shorter. So that kind of goes into the technique. So I think it's kind of interesting right now, like I mentioned, like there's a kind of a cool confluence of tradition, technique, and technology here. You know, tradition, people have been shortening ropes for a long time. They, like Tyler said, the iconic view of people climbing, coils over your shoulder. A bunch of techniques have kind of come up from that in this whole topic. But the technology piece, I think, is kind of interesting because we do have longer and longer and longer ropes, but we also have shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter ropes again. Like people are going, and I think maybe more in a guiding context, people are trying to bring the shortest rope possible because now we have the ability to buy ultra light, small, strong, high tenacity cords for like a pole line. So instead of carrying a really long rope to make the descent easier, and have to deal with all that rope, which you don't need on the ascent, but you need it to come down. Now you have this little lightweight rope that you could bring in your pack that you're never going to use except for the descent, or tools like the BL Escaper, where all of a sudden now you can bring a 40 meter rope and still rappel 120 feet and use the Escaper. Now, all of those things have their pros and cons, no, for sure. So I think you might see in a guiding context, people actually having less rope to manage, and some of the skill and art of managing that rope is being lost when we're talking about using really short ropes versus long ropes, which I think is kind of interesting in this whole conversation.
Yeah, I think is like with your point to tools and techniques, like we just have more options now than we used to, right? So we can be a lot more specific about what tools, and I'm speaking like of ropes and belay devices and descent tools, like for a specific objective. So we can kind of like whittle it down to what we barely, like just barely can get by with, which is a good mindset to some point, you know, to a point, but not always the best option, like slicing it that thin. So I think it's the paradox of choice, right? We have more options now, and now we got to choose the best option all the time. When ropes are only made 120 feet, not that long ago, didn't really have much options. So you got really good at managing that rope in a variety of settings. But
nice. And, you know, I think as we move into technique here a little bit, like the kind of the classic thing in my mind in shortening the rope is the kiwi coil, right? There are other ways to shorten the rope, which we'll get into, I hope. But it's kind of like, all right, now we're going to, let's just say that the each end of the rope, there's somebody on it, they're tied in, and now someone's going, or both people, depending on the competency of the team, is going to actually coil rope around their body, tie it off, and then that's how they're going to shorten the rope, and then they're going to move. And they always have the ability to take the rope off, to lengthen it out, for example, as we maybe get to harder climbing and we need to have a longer rope available. But that's kind of the main method of lengthening and shortening the rope, is the actual kiwi coil. Now, I think one of the things that's really important in this, in my mind, is when we're actually utilizing a technique like the kiwi coil and we're going to move over terrain, one of the things that comes to my mind is like, it needs to be comfortable. I'm looking for comfort, because if you're actually going to carry that rope on your shoulder, it kind of messes with some things like how you rack, how you have stuff on, you know, if you need to access a backpack. But then just the actual art of moving with like a thick coil over your body is kind of restrictive and cumbersome. And ultimately we want to be kind of fluid and free to kind of move how we want to. So I think that's a piece I tend to think about, is the comfort piece. I also tend to think about the efficiency of gaining the rope for more or less length. So maybe the be able to add or subtract rope from that system, and how quickly, because we want to be able to do that well and efficiently so we actually will do it. Because sometimes the rope's too short and we need more rope, and vice versa. And being able to be really fluid with that. I also think another piece to this is like just kind of going back to maybe that comfort piece, but more like a, if we extrapolate that to like a clutter piece, I want to make sure like my workstation, which is me, my harness and everything in front of me, is clean and neat. So when I want to have access to certain things, I just not have all this extra ropes and carabiners that are unnecessary in front of me. So I, once again, I can move fluidly through terrain and incorporate body belays and, you know, anchor belays as needed without having to undo a lot of stuff or have a lot of mess there. Also, when I want to shorten and lengthen the rope, I don't want to have a lot of mess there. And then I think one of the big pieces of this, like I mentioned earlier, is like, it's about a technique of transition. So it's like, what am I doing later? Shortening rope is just what I'm doing now, but ultimately I'm shortening the rope because I'm going to be doing something later. So I might be moving into more pitched technical climbing. Okay. So am I going to set myself up for that now? So once again, the efficiency I'm gaining of moving here with a shortened rope will be coupled with the efficiency of getting to this other point that I've set myself up for. Or I think even more so, the descent and getting yourself up and ready for the descent. Like, all right, I'm shorting the rope to short rope or short pitch to a technical descent. and having myself set up. So now it's really easy for me to facilitate that descent, maybe off some fixed anchors, for example. So those are some things I think about a lot when I'm actually choosing to put coils on my body. But let's just, Silas, well, actually, any thoughts on that? I kind of like went off the deep end a little bit.
No, that was great. I think you're spot on. What I hear you're saying is like, essentially we want to know where we're coming from, what we're going to do next, but also what we're going to do 2 steps from now, right? Like that's the transition, like what's going on now. And then we're going to ultimately, like, yes, like oftentimes traveling in a shortened rope, especially in a rock setting, is a mode of transition from one way of climbing to another way of climbing or descending. Right. And it could be vice versa also. But I think about, so I do a bunch of AMGA courses and exams, right? And I was on an exam in North Conway, and there's Whitehorse Slab, which is what, like a 6-pitch low angle route, a bunch of routes there. But so this is exam, and this candidate is really excited to use all these guidey tools. He just recently learned like the last year or two, right? So we get to the base of Whitehorse, and the candidate immediately coils like all the ropes 60 meters in the shoulder. He's like 30 feet out, ties me in, and like short rope me, marches me right up to the launch pad there. You know, it's like fourth class, third class to get to the launch pad, and then has me sit down, builds an anchor, unflakes the whole rope, which, you know, of course, taking off gasket like Kiwi coil style round loops takes a while. We do the 5 pitches to the top. And then we get to the top where it's like one more half pitch to the woods. And the candidate, again, like we're on an anchor, Kiwi coils all the rope, takes 10 minutes, Kiwi coils the rope, clips me in and marches off. And we short rope up the last like 80 feet, right? And then we come around the side through the woods for a little while. And we get to this anchor and he un-Kiwi coils all the rope and we do a rappel, right? So it's like, well, you looked really good while you were moving in the short rope and you short roped quite well, but was that the best use of your overall time? And if you had looked a little bit further ahead to the next step, as opposed to the step you want to do right now, you probably could have saved yourself transition time in almost all three of those cases. So for me, a lot of times younger guides in the approach pitch in a rock setting, we could just do another pitch to get going, right? And save that transition. At the top, we can do just another pitch to the woods and save that transition. And then where we most often will use it, or I'd advocate people use it, is getting down to, just walking down to an exposed anchor on the edge of a cliff. So it's all just really mellow terrain, but it's super duper exposed, right? And oftentimes doing like some sort of counterbalance on a tree or connecting the client to a tree. So the team is protected, short pitching kind of style, to then get the guide preferably to the anchor first if it's prudent. So yeah, I think your point's spot on. Like you want to know what's coming up 2 steps from now or 3 steps from now, so you don't just spend all this time getting into a shortened rope only to have to undo it 2 minutes later. I mean, it's okay, but it's not always the forethought we want to shoot for. And as far as carrying the rope goes, I think having the rope on you in a way, like all the rope on you on your shoulder, which does kind of suck, honestly, but being able to do it so you have access, like immediate access to the whole rope, is really important. So at least as a starting point, because it's really tricky, because when guides especially are either younger or less experienced, they can't see as far down the road, right? So they get presented with problems more often than more experienced guides will. So they don't just like see it coming down the road and sidestep it to avoid it. They kind of meet it head on, not knowing it's coming. And then they got to deal with this problem. Well, so if I'm now more experienced and I can sidestep the problem and prevent it from happening, I don't have to be as tech savvy and handle the problem that's occurred as you do when you're less experienced. So it's this double-edged sword where a young guide has to both be more tech savvy they're less experienced and not as likely to foresee it coming. So they actually have to be better than a more experienced guide dealing with those problems, yet they're still the less experienced guide. So it's kind of like a double whammy. If you're a younger or less experienced guide, you have to try to see further ahead, realize you're not, and then deal with all these problems and be better fixing the problems than you do in 10 years from now.
Yeah, I mean, there's a great quote from Einstein, and I'm going to bring it up to the 21st century, where a clever person solves a problem and a wise person avoids it. And that's the classic younger, less experienced guide. And I find that a lot of times younger, less experienced guides, like, they'll either coil this rope and try to short rope or short pitch or move with a short rope, either in the terrain that's too easy or too hard. Or like you said, it's too short. Like, there's no reason you should just pitch it out if it's that short. Like, if it's less than a rope length long, it doesn't make sense to spend all that time coiling your rope, because sure, short roping or short pitching might be more efficient in terms of movement, but you've blown all your time just changing your transition. So it's just better to bust up that terrain really quickly, build an anchor and belay them up. And then if you have longer stretches of that terrain, and to be honest, unless you guide a lot in the winter and the alpine terrain, you don't really come into a lot of short, like true short roping, short pitching terrain of long distances, in my opinion. If you're mostly cragging or whatever, or even doing just approaches, like, you have little sections, but to be in that mode for long periods of time, you really need to be in the mountains or in more significant terrain, where it's actually worth it to be in that mode for a long time.
Well, that's the thing too, right? Like, it's an alpine setting tool, because if we just pitched out the exposed fourth class all day, we'd never get there, right? So oftentimes we're trading as much immediate security by belaying pitches, and we're kind of getting closer to the edge of what's acceptable based on our client's ability by short roping, short pitching. And that's mainly to save time overall. I mean, you can still do it safely if you're skilled at it, of course. But really, in a rock setting, a cragging setting, there's almost like no reason to try to shave minutes or seconds by short roping when you could just short pitch. And that's kind of the thing, right? Like, if it's less than a rope length that you're moving, just do a pitch, whether you're a recreational party or a guided party. Like, just do a pitch like you would normally with the whole rope out, as opposed to even shortening it. Now, if you have to travel more than a couple rope lengths, yes, it absolutely makes sense at times to shorten the rope and travel either in a short roping, short pitching mode, or a simul climbing mode. But I say that phrase with some reserve, because we're not traveling in fifth class terrain simul climbing. We're often, it's like, as opposed to coming into that simul climbing mindset from a, well, let's go faster in fifth class terrain, I'd like to come into it from a, hey, let's not just solo this easier terrain, right? So you're adding security to a pretty mellow exposed piece of terrain, as opposed to trying to go faster in fifth class terrain, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. So I want to talk about actually creating the kiwi coil. And I remember very distinctly, like, the way I was initially taught how to kiwi coil is still exactly how I do it today, which is kind of awesome. And there are a few variations, and like, depending how you start it. But I think some things that should be, you know, people should think about is, like, what I see oftentimes when people kiwi coil is they don't get their initial, like, piece over their neck tight. Like, their coils have pieces that aren't tight and they don't adjust that. So kind of getting everything tight. And then as you coil, let's say we're actually going to coil a 6 meter rope, you got to be really careful of the length of the coils, right? If they're too short, you can't breathe, right? Because you're just compressing your chest, even though you can go shorter than you think. But if they're too short, you can't breathe. I almost think if they're too long is worse, because what happens is all of a sudden, like, two or three of them keep slipping over your shoulder all day. And it drives me bananas, totally bananas. And if you think about it, as you are coiling, right, and your coil is getting thicker and thicker and thicker on your shoulder, the length of the coils are getting slightly longer. So if you don't keep them nice and tight as you get further down the coil, you're going to have more coils that slip off your shoulder. So I think being really careful how you manage putting those coils on is really key. Now, remember also, these are round coils. They're not butterfly coils. So you're also going to introduce twists into the rope. So if you are going to coil your whole 60 meter rope and your client or the person at the end is tied in, guess what? You're probably going to have a whole bunch of coils there. So if you know you're going to coil all that rope and you're in a safe space, let's say you're on the ground before you move into this terrain, I might not have my client connected to that so I can let all the twists come out and then connect them in at the end. But if you're constantly going back and forth between all these coils and not, and you're staying tied in, you can develop just rope twists, which becomes rope handling issues in the mountains. But Silas, let's talk about like finishing the coil, because I think there's a lot of variation here. So now we have all the rope coiled, or however much we want coiled, then we need to tie it off safely so we can actually move. And there's a few different kind of, different things I'm thinking about. Like, are we moving on rock and snow? Are we on glaciated terrain? Are we going to actually be like in some fifth class where we may take belays for a short section? So we need a little more security in terms of how the rope's attached to us. And then once again, ease of uncoiling and coiling, but also maintaining that shortened counterbalance piece, right? If that's our primary safety piece. So let's say we're in a situation where we can't just be totally safe on a big ledge and just kind of like whatever, we're not using that, but we're actually in a position where we still need to keep that rope shortened. So now that we have all the coils up, and I know you've thought a lot about this, what's kind of like your nice clean, let's tie this off foundation? Remember, there's a lot of variations here. So just a foundation to start with.
Yeah, totally. Well, I might take a half step backwards.
Go for it.
And say, it only matters which shoulder the coils rest on if you're going to go get your IFMJ pin. Because the pin goes over your heart, which is your left side. So if you have the coils on your right side, then everyone can see your nice shiny pin.
Wow. I've never worried about that in the past.
That's the ongoing joke. That's the ongoing joke. I'm just kidding. So
you're not.
So the simple mechanics of using the rope, right? Like just being able to measure like 5 feet of rope is unbelievably helpful. So to your point, right? If you can start with the end of the rope and work and actually measure how much rope you think you're going to need to start, that's super helpful. So I might have the person untied from starting on the ground, even like tie their knot in place, their skeleton of their figure eight. And I might like count out 30 feet. Tie a bite knot, stack my whole rope, tie myself in, and then coil the whole rope to that knot till my hand hits the knot. I'll actually throw one coil off because for me, one coil is about 5 feet. And then I start tying off. And so like just the arm span, which I actually learned at Alpenglow, like selling cordage, like in Orono in college, like I used to measure cordage, right? Like on the counter. And I got really good at measuring exactly 5 feet, like kind of ridiculously good. I might have some OCD built in there, but I can measure 5 feet and I can get to the middle of a rope. If it's a 200 foot rope, I can get to the middle of the rope in 20 arm spans pretty fast. Even if it's dark and my middle mark's not well marked, I don't have a headlamp, right? So that stuff is really useful. Or you're on a glacier, traveling across the glacier, you got four people, right? Three people, but four people total in your group, you want a certain number of feet between each person because it's divisible by five. It helps a lot. Anyway, so to your question, tying off the actual kiwi coil, the place I often start with teaching people is just to have your coils pass the bite through the belay loop, do one pass underneath the coils. So the actual tongue kind of flops out by your belly button, and just a simple overhand around the load strand. And to me, that's the start of short roping. I don't know how much further you want to go right now, but that's for me the start.
Yeah. I mean, I think right there's even some details in there that are key, like going through your belay loop captures your harness into that system. It makes the coils and the harness one unit. Versus just going through the coils. Now, I still sometimes, and once again, this is, you got to think about why I might do this, but sometimes I'm in very, very mountainous terrain where I just need the barest minimum of a short roping. So I might just bring a very light rope and nothing else. And I don't actually have a belay loop to go through and capture, you know, because I'm just tied to the rope itself, or maybe just with a double length runner, even though it's hard to justify that now when you can buy a harness that weighs an ounce. But once again, I don't really need to capture my rope into my harness because the terrain is so inconsequential to some degree that I'm just using the rope very lightly. But if you have a harness on, there's no reason not to capture your belay loop. And then when you, I think the point you made, some of the points you made really key about if you're going to measure rope, measure the rope from the points that you actually want to be measuring from. So instead of from the end, you tie their knot first so you can see how much rope is already being taken up by that. So therefore you have that. And then it's always, almost every time I'm coiling, I'm like thinking about how much rope I want out. I'll look up at the train. I'll look up at the train. I'm like, and I'll just take one more loop off my shoulder. Because if you get exactly what you think when you coil, remember, it takes a loop off your shoulder to tie it off. And I've definitely had many times in my career where it's like just perfect. And I knew it was because I took that one loop off. And it's like such a satisfying feeling. But then totally. Once we actually tie the overhand on the bite, so, you know, also think of it's the second part of a mule hitch, right? It's a hard overhand onto the load strand. We want to make sure there's enough tail and we want to make sure it's tight. And I want to make sure that when I actually pull the load strand off my coil, which I oftentimes do just to cinch things up, that it's not too loose there. Like I want that to be good. I don't want that to be too long. I don't want it to be too short. I want it to be just right. And then tight as well. So we don't want to lose because we don't want the coils to come undone. Because if you are climbing, for example, and your coils are undone, you have round coils on, and all of a sudden you fall and counterbalance, guess what? A coil is going to tighten up around your chest and your neck. And that's not a good place to be. So the coils have to be tied off. Never move with coils that aren't tied off. Definitive answer.
Yeah, you're trying to isolate the strand of rope downstream of you, right? So, you know, accidents have happened where people have been short roping with a rope that wasn't tied to them in a guiding scenario and they drop the rope, right? Huge consequence. But the alternative is either you get strangled, right? Kind of pinched and yarded on, or if it's not as pulling on you as low as your belay loop is, you might get pulled off balance, like pulling on your shoulder, like on the coils. Is a really bad thing as well. So some people will isolate those coils free of their belay loop and then add something to the belay loop. And I'm like shorter people sometimes like that because the coils can be a certain length and not fall off their shoulders. Or sometimes really tall people like it too because the coils can be a little shorter but not pulling them down. It takes some practice to get it really comfortable, like to your point earlier. And if you want to, yeah, those coils can be, they don't have to be tied to the belay loop, but it has to be isolated from the top and bottom of those, the whole system.
Yep. Yeah, that's a subtle point, but a really important one.
And we're only talking about short roping so far, right? It's where the guide is not presumably going to fall like in a fifth class climbing scenario or correct. A glacier travel scenario.
Yeah. There's a couple of variations. So once you tie off your coil with the overhand, you know, there's some variations to actually finishing that, if you will. Like that's the most basic, simple way. It's the way I first learned how to do it. But if you want to, like, once again, add a little security so that knot does not come undone, so therefore your coils don't come undone. And if you're just doing a lot of short roping and short pitching, you sometimes don't notice that that stuff's loosening up if you're just kind of in the flow state. And then the knot's not really tight. So one little trick you can do is after you've tied the overhand and the bite, take the end of the bite and just do a half hitch over the top. That works really well. It's quite secure. It really holds. It's like finishing that knot. You can take that knot, the end of that knot, that bite, and clip it into your harness, which is different than what Silas was mentioning about isolating. It's just making sure the knot doesn't come undone. But you could do another knot. You know, there's a lot of ways you could do it, whatever. The key is making sure that's smooth and quick to do in transition in terms of shortening or lengthening. But now we're going to talk about when we actually isolate the two, right? Now we're going to clip into the belay loop But instead of clipping the knot that ties off the coil, we're actually clipping the load strand into our harness. So now, like Silas said, it actually puts the weight, if our system gets weighted to our harness, at our harness, which is a lower center of gravity. One of the big things I see a lot of guides do in short roping and short pitching, which is horrible, is that they tend to lean over towards the client or the person below them. So their center of mass is kind of leaning towards where their force is coming in, and instead of leaning really back away from that. Me being a smaller person, I'm really aggressive in my stance because I know I don't have as much weight and mass to counteract that. So I'm very, very leaning back. But if you're getting pulled higher up on your body, on your coils, that's just going to like make that worse, that phenomenon worse. So that's really important. But now we're going into tying, going in directly to our harness. So there's kind of really two main options. One is a clove hitch, right? Which we can clove hitch into our harness, which is really nice because it's adjustable. Sometimes it's nice to just tweak that a little bit, either direction. And then the other one that's really common would be like an overhand on the bite. So those are kind of two ways that we could clip into the harness. Now, Silas, you like to have, and me too, not just you, but there's a different reason why we choose one or the other, even though they are arguably interchangeable, but there's a time and place where one is definitely preferred and the other one is not.
Yeah, for sure. So I view, like we said, the tie off with nothing else is short roping mode. And do you know what the PITA factor is?
No.
It's an acronym, PITA.
I hate acronyms. Okay, but tell me this one.
Pain in the...
Okay.
Pain in the butt. So the PITA factor, we have to always think about the PITA factor, right? And that comes down to how complicated we make things and how good we are at doing things. And the reality is, like, if you're not as good at something or it takes more effort to do it because you've designed it poorly or complicated, you're less likely to do it. So in the case of short roping, your job as a guide is to make sure, to your point, make sure that rope length is correct all the time. And, you know, we say terrain repeats itself, right? In a macro kind of like geological sense. So the scale of terrain will repeat itself. And if your length of rope is not working, it's going to keep not working. But if it is working, it's probably going to keep working. So that's why we start with that really easy to manipulate and open up short roping style. So we want you to be capable of adjusting on the fly. Now, short pitching or fifth class climbing with a shortened rope, we're oftentimes using a clove hitch there because it is adjustable and it isolates the coils from the shortened rope. So you can fall on a clove hitch on your waist. Oftentimes we'll use like a triple action locker that also has a captured eye. So you're limiting the need or the risk rather of it opening the triple action locker, and you're limiting the potential for it to cross load with a captured eye. So like when I'm in Chamonix all summer, like a gridlock magnetron lives on my belay loop all summer because I'm always constantly adjusting where I am on a shortened rope with a clove hitch in climbing terrain. And then I pop on the glacier and then I change that clove hitch to an overhand and a bite. And the difference is because when it's hard to make the overhand and a bite like really tight and just the right length while you're climbing, it's kind of always hanging down the way. So a clove hitch is pretty tight and neat and tidy, but then on a glacier. So if my client or partner falls in the crevasse, right, I take that weight on my belay loop while I self-arrest. And if, so the method I would do from there is I self-arrest, build an anchor and transfer the load to that anchor, right? If that weighted clove hitch, I transfer the load to my anchor. Now I move down a little bit to unweight the clove hitch. I can't get that carabiner out of the clove hitch very easily under load. So on the glacier, I'll go into an overhand on my waist. And if that overhand is loaded with the person falling in the crack, I could clip something else into that carabiner now to transfer the load easily, take a half step downhill and simply unclip myself from that bite really easily. So overhand and a bite typically is glacier travel mode, hard knot. Fifth class climbing is more the clove hitch. Both allow you to take the coils off your body while still maintaining a shortened rope, and then do something with that rest of the rope that is the coil, the QE coil is part of it. Either rig a rappel, rig a haul system, build an anchor, get someone else involved to help you pull, whatever the case may be.
Right. Yeah, nice. So some other things I was thinking about was, once again, as we envision of what we're about to do later, and we're kind of getting ourselves set up now, kind of in a shortened rope system. Like, sometimes I'll do things like, I might do more than one coil. I might have an initial coil, and then I'll have another coil on top of that. So now I'm moving through short roping, knowing that I'm going to get to a point where I might need to lengthen the rope. And I already have that kind of preset. I don't have to, like, I just literally untie it and drop those coils, and I have all of a sudden 40 more feet of rope to go. And I can still, but I'm still shortening the rope overall. So I think about that, and, you know, little things like if you are, you know, once again, you kind of get above that harder climbing, now you need to compress the rope down again. You can just shorten those coils, and you don't have to untie your initial coil. Like, I'll just shorten the coils, put it over my shoulder, and then I'll just tie off both coils through my belay loop as one big coil now. That way you don't have to constantly fiddle with untying and retying. It's like, just leave it there and then just do it all in one go. And I find that that can be a really useful trick. And a time saver is just understanding that when, like, we still need a shortened rope, but we need to go shorter or longer depending on what we see above us, is really key. A little piece I was thinking about too was kind of, I mentioned this earlier, the clutter piece. So I like to be comfortable when I'm moving with all this stuff, but I want less clutter in front. So I think about when I'm moving more in short roping and short pitching, besides the carabiner that I might have on my harness, if I'm more short roping, I might not have any carabiner closing that coil off, as Silas mentioned. So I have a carabiner on my harness free just to maybe throw a quick munter on, a quick body belay, kind of easy in and out. As we start adding more carabiners to our harness, like, and adding some more definitive security, like a clove hitch, for example, to our harness, you know, I don't want to keep stacking more and more and more stuff there because I need that workspace to be clean. So it's always a kind of a delicate balance about how you're choosing to deal with the rope, how much stuff you have there, and how much clutter that is, both in terms of actually manipulation, but also visually. I think people don't always understand or appreciate how much visual clarity helps. When things are really cluttered, it's very confusing, especially in a situation where maybe your stress is a little bit higher, or you're fatigued or whatever. So I think those are pieces I oftentimes think about. And I also am thinking about not carrying a lot of coils on my body whenever I can. That's my personal preference. Like the example we kind of talked about, like having 60 meters of rope and coiling most of it, like, you know, 55 meters, and then just doing something with the rest and kind of constantly going back and forth. There are times and places for that. But if I don't have to do that, I will not do that, because that much rope management in terms of time, but a comfort, is not worth it most of the time. For me. So I'm a big fan of putting some rope in my backpack. And this is where technology is kind of interesting, because now the backpacks are so good and they're so small that everybody's climbing with these tiny, tiny, tiny little backpacks and guiding, which is great for movement over technical terrain, right? You really want to have that nice tight package. But as a guide, especially if I'm climbing terrain that has maybe less technical climbing, or the climbing is pretty moderate, and I have a lot of short roping, short pitching, a lot of that kind of terrain to move through, and couple that with maybe long approaches and descents, I actually want a backpack that's comfortable enough to handle that day, but also big enough that I can stack some rope into it while I'm in that kind of more third, fourth class, even low fifth class terrain, or snow terrain, for example. So I don't have to have all the rope on my shoulders, because I find that very annoying. And tiresome, but it does require a slightly bigger backpack. So I think sometimes people don't account for that when we actually have longer ropes in the game.
Yeah, I would say for me, like the less you know about what's coming up, the more options you need to have. So the very first time I guided the Grand Teton for Exum, quite a while ago, I think I had two clients, and Exum does this thing where they have 35 meter ropes because that's the rappel length. So each, basically you bring a 35 meter rope for each client and you have a caterpillar or a parallel kind of setting, right? So I leave the hut and I have one rope completely kiwi coiled on me. I've got my harness on, I'm fully racked, helmets on, headlamps on, clients are fully kitted out, I've got gloves on. And like, I am ready for anything that comes up, right? Because it's all new to me. I don't know exactly what I'm gonna see. Now, by the 20th time I guided the Grand Teton, I knew every inch of that mountain really well. I had a really great handle on conditions. Like, I really knew exactly what I was gonna find. So then I would leave the hut without my harness even being on, right? You can walk for 20 minutes with no harness on. And I had both ropes fully like backpack coiled and rack in the backpack, et cetera. So I could go into that terrain, that same terrain, with way fewer options and be as good at managing the risks because I knew more about what was coming up, right? So you have to be more conservative and have more options the less you really know for sure. And that's kind of like alpine terrain in general, is that there are lots of things that can be variables, and you just got to have like all of them figured out if you're going to limit your options at all, right? Because if the rope's in your backpack and you need to really do like an 80-foot, 100-foot pitch here, the PETA factor is high. Like, you're not going to pull out that rope. You're going to try to make it work by short pitching it, when in your heart of hearts, you probably know you should be like fully pitching it out. So those are two things I think about a lot. Like, yes, you can fully limit your options and get really styly and prioritize your comfort if you know really well what's coming up. And the same goes for number of clients too. Like, in my mind, we've kind of been talking about just one client so far in this conversation, but having two obviously introduces a whole bunch of variables.
Oh yeah.
If people find this stuff interesting and you want to actually use it like in your daily guiding, they should do an alpine guide course, because the alpine guide course, like, it should almost be called the short roping course. That's what you do constantly, like for 10 days straight, is learn how to short rope and short pitch in mountains, both snow, rock, and ridges and that sort of thing.
Yeah. You know, like I said, I think there's a lot of interesting stylistic differences and experience differences that kind of go into this. And, you know, I have found a really useful tool for me is, like, let's just say we're approaching something and I know I'm going to get roped up at some point, but I don't know when and whatever. Like, I still really like, I'll take the time oftentimes, if we get to a point, put helmets on, harnesses on, kind of getting prepared way before we need that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, all right, I know this is going to happen sooner and we have some third, fourth class train, but we're going to get prepared here at a safe spot. I actually, as my client is doing that, like, I'll take the time oftentimes and I'll stack the rope in my pack and have the end out ready to go, you know, clipped off to my harness. So that way, all of a sudden, it's like, ooh, now there's a little step here, especially if I don't know that area at all. Instead of stopping and uncoiling the rope and kind of shortening it, I'm like, I'm already ready. So when we move in, and I've never been there before, I'm ready just to pull some rope out, get them attached, clip the rope to me at the length I want. The rest is in my pack. I don't have any coils on and I'm just moving. And now we have a shortened rope and we're getting to wherever we need to go using terrain features or anchoring, whatever happens. And then if all of a sudden we're in a situation where we need more rope and we're in counterbalance, I can stay clipped in, pull more rope out of my pack, clip that into my harness, right? And then do whatever I need to do, maybe get a belay or whatever from there. But I'm constantly moving and kind of utilizing that rope in my bag as the staging point, and then just adding more as I need. But then at that point, I can also shorten it over my shoulder to make it short again, which is kind of cool. And I really, really liked that. And then I also think, you know, once again, some subtle things, like if I know we're going to get into longer pitched climbing, instead of just having the end of the rope stacked at the bottom and the other end coming out, I'll be tied in, right? And then I'll stack the rope in on top. So now the rope that goes to the clients on the top of the pile, so same thing, we're going to shorten the rope. The rope just comes out of my backpack. There's two strands that come out of my backpack, one that's tied to me and one that's on the top of the pile that gets clipped to me as we shorten that rope. And then once again, the same process can happen. I can either utilize just that length and then lengthen the rope out of my backpack as needed, or shorten it by coiling. But oftentimes, if I know I'm going to do like more short roping, but not untie from the rope personally myself, and I don't want to coil 200 feet of rope, I'm going to stack like 100 feet of rope in my pack and have 40, 50, 60 feet of coils or whatever I want, like essentially whatever of that second half on my body, and then the rest in my hands. And that way it's a much more comfortable, manageable thing for me as I'm moving through. And it gives me all the options. So like, once again, if I'm tied in, I can use that to clip in, you know, to an anchor versus on the being counterbalanced. All of a sudden we can go right into pitching because we're both tied in, both clove fixed separately, and it's good to go. So a lot of little tricks to play with. And I think, like you said, Silas, earlier, like this is a really great technique of getting into anchors to descend. And this is where I also think that not just coiling all the rope to get to this short distance into an anchor is really key. So if I'm going to just short rope 50 feet, because that makes sense, or whatever, let's say 150 feet, right, to get to an anchor, I might just butterfly all that over my shoulders and then just clip in the length that we need, get into our transition, and then, you know, transition to a technical descent and go from there, versus coiling all of that rope with a kiwi coil just to uncoil all that rope right there. All we need to do is a simple butterfly over the shoulder and we're done. And then as we have longer sections of short roping or short pitching, and I think, you know, Red Rocks descents is a really a place for this. It comes to my mind kind of a more just a rock setting, is like, once again, we get to the top of the climb. There might be sections where we don't need to be roped, maybe to start with, but then we know we're going to go into some gully. So I'm going to have the rope stacked in my pack, ready to go. But this is kind of the key. A subtle difference is I'll actually stack the rope in my pack backwards. So I'll put the client end on the bottom and I'll put the free end on top. And I'll only use less than half of the length of the rope for between me and my client. So essentially, as we're short roping and short pitching, we get to say some fixed rings. I've got the free end coming out of my backpack. I can essentially get us in counterbalance or however we want to choose to be secure. I just take the free end out of my rope, out of my backpack, feed it to the rings, and I can pull it all the way through. So I have the middle in the rings with plenty of distance, so we're not impacting where the middle mark is. And that's like kind of a subtle, that's one of the things I was really interested in this conversation in general, is like, there's so much like little cool, subtle things that if you know them, it all of a sudden makes everything flow so well. And it's such a beautiful, it's probably my favorite type of guiding and movement is in this gray world of flowing and understanding where you're going. And like you said, if you know less, you can set yourself up with those little tricks to really just like style it versus like constantly having to manipulate lots of rope one way or the other just to set some rappel rings up. And I think that's what's really interesting. And I was doing some of that the other day guiding, and it just, my brain kind of was like, I gotta talk about this. I gotta talk to Silas about this to the world. So interesting.
Yeah, I think it's great. I think it's a really awesome topic and fun to practice with. I think people need to get good with it. Like there's kind of, in my mind, there's the like two real sides of it. There's the mechanical side of it, like actually tying kiwi coils and tying off the knots or tying off the rope, getting the distances right. And then there's the whole terrain assessment side, right? So, you know, a lot of folks, like the rope is on, we're climbing, and it's like, well, yeah, that's fine, but man, if you just use the rope in a more subtle way, like not, I mean, yes, it's there for fall protection, but the more powerful way of using a shortened rope is by keeping your client close so they can watch where you go. You're going slow but steady, so you're moving constantly. And that gives you a chance to be reading the terrain. This is assuming going uphill, I should say, since we're just talking. We're going uphill. So I'm route finding ahead of me, finding the easiest way to go, the least exposed way to go. The client's just right there, right at that nice like zone 2 heart rate behind me, looking at my feet, knowing where to go. And we're just like you said, flowing through the terrain, right? And because we have a rope on, it both keeps them close to model. It keeps them close to pace. And I know what's going on for them. Like I know if they're breathing too hard or if we're going, because we're going too fast, right? If we're talking, maybe I can go a little faster, you know? So there's just so much there that's really powerful with the connection of the rope. That's really not even in regards to the fall protection per se. If you can flow through that terrain, read the terrain well, find the easy way, the non-technical way, and have a rope on, oh man, like now you're just totally winning.
Yeah, I mean, we literally could talk about all the other aspects of short roping and short pitching, but to me, this whole conversation really was inspired, but literally, like you said, it's about the management of the rope in a shortened state and how that affects us and how we move through terrain. So it touches on so many pieces of just mountain travel and mountain craft. And to be honest, a lot of these techniques that we actually use are quite old when we're traveling to the mountains and dealing stuff with ropes, but just to be able to manipulate a shortened rope and understand that is pretty awesome. I got a great quote here. It's from Chauvin. Terrain before rope and rope before despair.
So Chauvin. That's so great.
But
yeah,
it's really a beautiful thing. I might be out. I might be done. I mean, I'm not done, but I feel like we've covered a long journey, but it really was inspired about shortening the rope and all the little concepts that go to why we do that. So we have to know why we're going to shorten the rope first, and then we decide how we're going to shorten the rope. You don't just shorten the rope. You don't just do the how first. There's why are we doing it, and then how are we doing it, coupled with the vision of where we're going to be, not where we are necessarily right now. That's part of it. We have to understand where we're going to be in the future so we actually get the why and the how maximized to make all those transitions and efficiencies, you know, combined. So we're just moving more fluidly through the mountains, even though we might be at a slower pace, we're not wasting time with the rope work. And I do think that's a place where I see a lot of people, even in kind of alpine training, they lose a lot of time manipulating the rope too much. Either they're not practiced enough to do it really efficiently, or they just, like you said, they coil 55 meters of rope just to short rope 80 feet to pitch it out and then have to undo it. It's like, you're just wasting time, you know, and you're not seeing the whole picture and the why you're going to choose to do that. You just did the how I'm going to do it, which is very different. So, absolutely. So I don't know if you got anything else, but I'm tapped out for tonight. I got to go buy some groceries for a 5-day trip.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, my closing comments would be this. If you're unsure, you should pitch it out if you're going up. If you're unsure going down, you should just rappel. Like, those are the simple things, right? Like, if you're in real terrain and you're wondering, should I short rope or pitch it? You should pitch it. If you're coming down, can I short rope this? Not sure. You should rappel. Like, keep it simple, right? On the other end of the spectrum, like on the more moderate, like, should I add a rope here? If you're unsure if you should add a rope, you should definitely add a rope and start short roping. So yeah, like people have died on both ends of those of that equation. People have died not being roped up when they arguably should have been. And people have died by short roping in terrain where they should have been pitching it out or rappelling. This is a sharp tool. You got to be really careful. And you've got to be conservative. Like, if you're ever not sure, you have to be more conservative. Like, we're cutting closer to the edge of what's acceptable here by doing some short roping, short pitching. And man, that edge cuts both directions, and you've got to be really careful getting close to it. If you blow it, these are not like fender bender accidents. They're like real deal people dying sort of accidents. So put a rope on early. If you're not sure, you can always take it off. If you're unsure about moving together, don't move together. That's where I would end my part of the conversation for sure.
Yeah, fair enough. I was already thinking like, oh, there's all these other things I want to talk about. No, we're done now. That's it.
Nick, thanks so much. It's a pleasure again, as always.
Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. But yeah, this is a real game. Shortening the rope and moving together on a shortened rope is a real game. So definitely get some good mentorship before you just do it. Because once again, a rope used improperly in the mountains is more dangerous than it is secure. So,
and use a real rope. Like, don't use a cordelette. Don't use a half rope. Use a single rated rope.
Yeah.
They make 8.5 these days.
I mean, the irony is that we oftentimes use counterbalance in these systems. And if you're on snow, that's one thing, but on rock, and you're going to counterbalance two people on a rock ridge with an 8.5 millimeter single rope, we'll see how long that lasts. You know, absolutely. So, I mean, this is where technology can come into play, because there are ropes that have higher cut resistance from a couple of different brands, with kind of incorporating some interesting technology. So we all want the smallest ropes, but remember, small ropes cut. So
light is right until it's not.
That's right. You're right till you die. So, all right. On that note, we're calling tonight. Thanks, Tyler.
Thanks, Dick.
Talk to you later.